Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman to our airwaves. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you have an astronomy-related question, you can also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can hit our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC radio. You'll see a Vox Pop wall post there where you can comment. You can also comment at the bottom of today's Vox Pop page on our website, wamc.org/voxpop, a spot to comment there. Email us if you wish, voxpop@wamc.org. But by all means, call. It's good for call-in shows. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. He's got a new book. It's entitled Zoom. It's on Little Brown. Bob, what's the new one about?
Well, thanks, Ray. Great to be here. Well, it's about motion. Everything that moves. The subtitle is How Everything Moves, from atoms and galaxies to blizzards and bees. I had to think about what it was. It's such a long subtitle. So Zoom really explores everything because everything moves. I learned a lot in the 2 years I had to actually learn stuff to write the book.
So everything moves. Atoms are essentially vibrations, right?
Yes. And vibrations, I'm so glad you said that, are the big surprise for me, because we all know that the planets move and they also spin as they're moving. But a third thing is happening, not just to planets and to the sun and everything. And everything is rapidly pulsating or vibrating. And that means everything. As we look around the room, our bodies, everything is vibrating. For example, you'd think that water ice would be made of these solid, immovable molecules of water, you know, H2O, two of hydrogen, one of oxygen. But it turns out that they stretch away from each other, the atoms, and then they snap back like as if they were on a rubber band.
Yeah.
At the same time, they rock back and forth like a pendulum, and then they twist and then return to shape. And all of these motions of twisting and wagging and rocking and stretching, you'd think it would dampen out over time, but it never does. It just keeps vibrating between a trillion and 100 trillion times a second. And all of this has real consequences in everyday life. And the study of the sun, that it vibrates, new field called helioseismology that tells us what's below the surface that we don't see.
So how on earth did a man who writes about astronomical things, things far away, come up with this topic?
Right. Well,
are you out of other topics? Is that it? This is
well. I really wanted to expand, because everything in science and physics, I think, is fascinating, and there is some about the universe. There's some astronomy in there. Quantum phenomena that are infinitely fast. We've only known about this in our lifetimes, really. That information or something travels from the farthest reaches of the universe to us in zero time at all. So it's not as if it's faster than light speed, it's that it's no speed at all, infinitely fast to arrive here or to go from here to someplace else. But on the other hand, the galaxies that we're observing that seem to be rushing away, the farthest ones, at the speed of light, are really not moving at all. They're just hanging out, and it's the empty space between us and them that's stretching.
So what sort of things can you extrapolate from your research into vibrations to the larger, the huge universe?
Well, the vibrations on the tiniest level affect us on the larger levels. Let's start with summer. We just noticed that the news, somebody's going on trial because they locked their kid in a car.
Yeah, that's going on right now.
And the poor kid, you know, died in a hot car. Well, the reason cars get so hot is because the fast vibrations of visible light, typically 500 trillion times a second, can pass through glass. But infrared light has a different vibration level, a different frequency that just matches the natural vibration of the atoms in glass. So because of that, there's a kind of chaotic barrier that prevents infrared, or what we think of as heat, from leaving. So visible light gets in, warms up the car seats and everything else, but the heat can't escape. This is the greenhouse effect. Mm-hmm. That's why the car gets hotter and hotter and hotter, and it's all because of these tiny vibrations. But even on the largest scale, this guy Torricelli taught us how the wind blows. You know, nobody knew since ancient times of all the motions of tides, and that's what we explore in Zoom, tides and waves. Did you know they come every 8 seconds, ocean waves on average?
I did not know that.
And that they travel about as fast as cars in moderate traffic, about 45 miles an hour, ocean waves. What I didn't know is that as a wave gets closer and closer to shore, two things. The wavelength, which is how long the wave is, and the wave height. Well, when the bottom of the sea, when it gets to shallower waters, mm-hmm. the seabed is less than one half of a wavelength from the wave, from below it, it slows down the base of the wave, but the top, which is tons of water, keeps moving forward from inertia. So what happens is when you watch a wave, you see the top leaning forward more and more because it starts to move faster than the base.
Yeah.
And then when the ratio reaches 1:7, it can't support itself anymore, and it breaks. That's what we say.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense. By the way, the number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. He has a new book entitled Zoom on Little Brown. 1-800-348-2551 if you want to join in. I heard a science piece yesterday, about tides. And the point was made that the tides are really the land moving, and there are tides on the moon as well, even though there's no water. And that blew my mind.
That's right. The solid Earth has a tide of about 8 inches, which is very little. We're really well constructed for our entire planet to just deform by 8 inches since we've got this huge object, the moon, that's so close to us. And but the ocean tides average 3 feet out in the open sea, 5 feet when you get closer to shore. And so you've got tides, you've got waves, and you've got currents. So two of the chapters actually looks at these different things of water and these strange, freaky consequences of waves and these motions. As I said, the waves coming in every 8 seconds on average and all the rest. Or the stuff in your body, like digestion. How fast does that move? And blood.
You're covering digestion and blood now?
There's a whole chapter about the stuff inside your body, like what's the fast stuff and what's the slow stuff and how fast do germs move. And one thing I learned, I know I'm almost speaking over myself because it's actually very exciting. It was exciting while I researched it, and Zoom ended up being a very, very exciting book to write, is that as the blood that goes through your body gets to the capillaries, you'd think it would move faster because you know how kids like squeeze the end of a garden hose because they want to squirt their friends?
Sure.
And if you narrow it, you make the water squirt faster.
Yeah.
So you'd think that as the blood reaches the capillaries, they'd move faster, but they don't because there's so many more capillaries that the volume increases.
Oh.
So it actually slows down to walking speed.
Wow. You consistently amaze me, and now you've really done it. So how do you tie it all in? What's the grand overarching theme here as we talk of vibrations in your new book, Zoom?
Well, it starts with the whole universe, which is the grandest thing that we see expanding, and then it gets into first slow stuff like molasses. Slow is molasses. Well, what do we mean by how slow is molasses? I actually had to research the stuff. The poles, the shifting poles, which the magnetic poles actually move 37 miles a year. That's the length of a living room per hour. And they're really shifting. You know, people, especially in Woodstock near where I live, are really worried about the poles shifting. So we look at how many times has it happened before? Which way are they going? Why are they speeding up? They're going the wrong way until the end of the 17th century. They were actually heading south.
Yeah.
And now they're heading north over the top of Earth. And if they keep going, they're going to go down the other side. Canada has already lost them. The North Magnetic Pole was in Canada until just 2 years ago. You know, first they have a bad maple syrup year, and now this.
Okay, well, that's a perfect spot to take a break. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. We'll get to your calls in a minute. 1-800-348-2551. Vox Pop Astronomy, Bob Berman. Your calls coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from the 1850 House Inn and Tavern, Rosendale, New York. Historic boutique hotel offering romantic Hudson Valley getaways, 11 guest rooms, modern amenities, expanded outdoor deck overlooking the Rondout River, the1850house.com. Washington County Tourism, celebrating Independence Day throughout the county with parades, music, carnivals, activities for children and adults, and fireworks, washingtonnycounty.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. AshfieldStone.com. Proctor's, presenting the 2014-2015 Key Private Bank Broadway Series, featuring Newsies, Jersey Boys, The Illusionists, Witness the Impossible, Annie, Pippin, and Kinky Boots. Proctors.org. And The Glass Onion, Block Island, Rhode Island. Since 1989, offering apparel, jewelry, body care, books, home and garden supplies, and kids' gear, featuring local vendors on the island's main street, glassonionblockisland.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. By the way, just an FYI, we have a severe thunderstorm watch. Not a warning. Don't panic. Don't get under the coffee table. It's a watch for Albany, Columbia, Fulton, Greene, Montgomery, Rensselaer, Saratoga, Schenectady, Schoharie, Warren, and Washington counties, going until 8:11 p.m. Exactly 8:11. So we'll keep you posted if that turns into a warning for anybody. Now, the vibrations I'm feeling right now, there must be somebody on the phone. Jasmine in Lenox. Jasmine, you're first.
Hello.
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 You're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
You want to talk on the radio?
I do. I'm ready.
You're on.
Okay. I have a question. What is going on with this storm, the pull of the tide, the moon, and tropical storm? What's going to happen to the shoreline?
Okay.
Well, the pull of the moon isn't really that relevant to this particular storm, but you know, it all adds up together. A lot of people don't realize that what the moon really does is it doesn't directly pull on the water, but there's a difference between its tug on the side of Earth closest to it and farthest away from it. And this difference in the gravity is what produces tides. It's not the gravity itself. It's a difference in gravitational pull. But the storms are so much more powerful than any particular tidal effect for the moment that, yeah, that's what's doing. We're just talking about mice. So I was hoping you'd ask about mice. But you
how would they know that? We were in a break. We weren't on the air talking about it. All right, Jasmine, can you ask something about mice?
Well, am I supposed to?
Sure, why not? Why don't you play along?
About mice on the planet, little mice, like the little...
Yes, exactly, mice. I'm so glad you asked, because we're talking about that, how fast things are, or depend on how many body lengths they shift in a second. For example, a jumbo jet, when it's coming in for landing, almost looks like it's hanging there motionless because it's so big, 230 feet, that it shifts only one jumbo jet length per second. But mice can shift 5 mouse lengths per second. They're only 8 miles an hour. No mouse has run faster than 8 miles an hour. You could outrun a mouse in a straightaway.
Well, and that's why they use them for all of the experiments medically.
Oh, yeah.
Because they can catch them?
That's...
I see. I understand.
It's really true.
Jasmine, you played along very nicely. Thank you very much for that.
I appreciate
the call. Let's go to Matt in Albany. Matt, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
Good.
Just had a question for you, a little broader in scope. If we could segue from mice to rats in the trap. With regard to global climate change, I know there's many different opinions in contemporary media regarding it. But my question is, in the course of your research for this book, which I'm excited to read, with regard to either astrophysics or with regard to the roles played by the keystone species that we see disappearing, such as honeybees and things of that nature. I mean, did you come across anything in your research, or are you aware of anything in your that you discovered throughout your research that, that may be employed to help us combat global climate change, or do you have any theories yourself?
Well, this new book, Zoom, doesn't deal with that, but the most recent book, I can mention it because it's not a plug anymore because it was it's years old now,
right.
The Sun's Heartbeat, spent two chapters on that. And yes, there, very definitely. And one of the takeaways there is that our climate change is, of course, partially from our carbon output, but there's three other factors that also are produce warming or cooling on a larger scale. One is the presence or absence of volcanoes, and one is whether there's an El Nino going on or not. But the next one is the sun. As we all know, there's a period of time from 1645 to 1715 when the sun went essentially dead. Its heartbeat stopped. There was no...
It didn't go dead. The sun's Maunder minimum. The sunspot stopped.
Exactly. The sunspot stopped. The mini ice age is what our caller just said, and quite right. And recently, the sun has been almost doing that same thing again. We've had the longest sunspot cycle in anyone's memory. That is a 14-year instead of a 11-year cycle. It's the fifth dimmest one on record. It's a very, very weak maximum. And the minimum that we had in 2005, 6, 7 was deeper than any we've seen. And the takeaway from that is that that has cooled our climate. That has a little bit of a cooling effect. So if our global warming has plateaued a little bit, even though 2010 was the warmest year ever, and before that it was 2005, and before that it was 1998. We're still getting record warm years, but they're not going up anywhere near as fast as they did before. And that's probably because the sun has been so quiet, and some believe it'll continue to be quiet for years to come, that it's buying us a little bit of time, that it's helping us out.
Okay. Buying us a little bit of time, but I also fear it could be lulling us into a false sense of security.
Right, exactly, exactly. Some of us are afraid of that, too.
Matt, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We're welcoming Bob Berman today. His new book is Zoom. On Little Brown, it's all about mice and vibrations and such. Malcolm in Sunderland. Malcolm, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Wonderful show, and I can't thank you both enough.
Well, thank you.
You're also a little bit faint in my phone, so I hope you're hearing me.
Okay.
My question had to do with the... I saw something recently posted about some scientists who managed to use quantum particles. I guess they transferred data basically instantly using entangled particles. Spooky action at a distance, I guess. my question has to do... Well, I... You know, couldn't help but thinking about some of the future possibilities of this, such as, you know, for communication, instant communication from, you know, I guess just about anywhere in the universe, if you think about it, and also for data storage and, you know, all kinds of data stuff like that. You'd have basically instant backup of data from, you know, to wherever your other particles are.
What data did they manage to transfer instantaneously? I've not heard of this.
Yeah, because I'll tell you what, communication would be a little iffy because although you're absolutely right, EPR correlations or particle entanglement is instantaneous, zero time for the information to get from a particle to its twin. We can't control it. Each one of those is random. So all the relativity people say, well, this doesn't violate relativity because you can't use it to send communication because you never know what the next thing is going to happen. The next collapse from a wave function, in other words, the wave function collapse can be random to one state or to another state, and then its entangled twin will do the opposite. But you don't know which it's going to be. So actually exploiting this is another issue. We'll see whether they can do it. But it's very, very exciting. I'm glad you said spooky action at a distance because that's the key there.
So in other words, if they were successful in doing this, then it would render the theory of relativity invalid?
Maybe. The relativity people say, well, there's a second thing. We're not really accelerating anything of mass to the speed of light.
So information is not mass?
Yes.
In fact, they're not accelerating anything at all. They're just using this behavior to essentially... You know, have the data that you want to indicate by, you know, one behavior of this particle on one side of, you know, wherever it is, it just gets mimicked by this behavior of a entangled particle wherever else it is. So there's nothing actually moving or, you know, violating Einstein's laws.
That's right. I spend actually almost a whole chapter of that in Zoom because it's so amazing.
It is amazing.
That, and Einstein, and this is one of those rare cases where Einstein was just dead wrong on this. And you quoted him by saying spooky action at a distance. That was his put down. That was his pejorative when he said,
right.
No, that couldn't really happen. If that happened, that would be spooky action at a distance. But now we know it's real. There really is spooky action at a distance.
Malcolm, great call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good one. Let's go to Leonard in Greenfield Center. Hi, Leonard, you're on.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call, and I love your shows when I catch them.
Thank you. I
understand that at absolute zero, all motion stops. All the vibrations of inside an atom stops. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Now, what happens to the electrons that are whizzing around the atom?
Well, at minus 459.67 degrees Fahrenheit, absolute zero, you have a new state. Instead of the actions that you had before, any atoms around all blur into a single solid, kind of a non-atom or super atom or super ball, if you prefer, called the Bose-Einstein condensate. So you don't have atoms and electrons going around the way we did before. You don't have that. You instead lose the individuality of subatomic particles, and it all blurs into a new material. And you can bet that come back a century from now or two centuries from now, you know that old famous saying that technology 50 years in the future will be indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah.
Well, 50 years in the future, when we figure out how to economically produce absolute zero, there's going to be inventions and technology from that we can't even imagine today. Shoot light into this material, and it slows down to almost a stop. It slows down to less than freeway speeds, for example.
So that electronic cloud out there just kind of freezes itself, and that cloud doesn't shrink or anything, but it's
the
time?
Yes, everything, that's right. And everything blurs into, not only the electrons, but even the atoms themselves all turn into a single undifferentiated state where you can't tell each atom from another.
And the mass stays the same?
Right. The mass of the
conglomerate
stays the same. You know that old saying that you can't, in quantum theory, says that you can't know where a particle is and how it's moving. You can't know both, right, Ray? You can't, never supposed to
right,
be able
Bob,
to know
I'll play,
both.
Play along.
Well, in this case, if you freeze something to absolute zero, minus 459.67 degrees, well, it stops moving, so you know where it is. It's right there. It has no motion. So the idea that you can't know the motion and the position, here we do know the motion and the position. So at first,
because there's no motion.
That's right. And there is a position because it's sitting right there. So you'd think this would be a violation, an escape clause, a reason why quantum mechanics is wrong. No. Matter managed to fool us, and you still can't know the positions of the individual atoms because they've all blurred into a single undifferentiated ball.
But they've lost any wave function, and they're an actual physical thing.
Yeah, they're still a physical thing, but this is we talked about spooky new properties. It's like a fifth state of matter.
Wow. It's only 2:33, and we're already at this stage. Amazing. Gene in Del Mar. Gene, you're on.
Thank you. I was on the phone, and I think maybe Mr. Berman has already answered the question. He referred to information traveling across the universe instantaneously, and I'd like to know what data convinced him of that recently.
Well, actually,
quantum entanglement has been known for years.
But actually, the caller mentioned an experiment that neither Bob nor I were aware of. So,
but I'll tell you, I'll answer the caller's question. In 1998, that's how we knew for the first time. It was Nicolas Gissin in Geneva who first settled the issue of whether Einstein was right, that this was just some contamination of or local effects in the experiment, or whether this kind of spooky action at a distance was real. What he did was he used fiber optics, and he sent photons, bits of light, 11 kilometers apart, figure about 6 miles apart, where they had to make a choice one way or the other. And whichever one of the entangled particles did, the other did the complementary action at least 50,000 times faster than the speed of light would have required to travel those 6.5 miles. That was the testing limit. Presumably, it was instantaneous. And a few years later, when people said, wait, this can't be. There must be something wrong with the experiment. Maybe there was a bias in selecting just those objects that acted in sync. Well, David Wineland at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who I spoke to right after that in 2001, then did an experiment using heavy objects, beryllium ions that sealed the case, and high detector efficiency to show, I'm answering the caller here, that it's really real. That this spooky action in the distance or the particle entanglement instantaneously without any pause, even for light speed, is a reality. So we've known that now. It's been sealed for about 13 years.
Mm.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Appreciate sure. the call very much. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Dennis in Kingston. Dennis. Hello, Dennis. Are you there?
Hello, Dennis.
Dennis, you got to get nearer to your phone. Okay. Well, sorry, Dennis. Dennis is napping. I can hear that he's there. It's the way it goes. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. And a reminder, we do have a flood watch. I should say a thunderstorm watch up there. I tell you, there are blue skies outside of the studio at the moment, but there is a watch for Albany, Columbia, Fulton, Greene, Montgomery, Rensselaer, Saratoga, Schenectady, Schoharie, Warren, and Washington until 8:11
tonight. How are they saying 8:11?
Well, I'd love to know. In fact, yesterday there was a thunderstorm warning that came over from the National Weather Service till 2:44. And then at the same time, Jessica had a weather radio on and said till 3:13.
Well, you can see a warning to that because they're calculating how fast the thunderstorms are moving.
Right, but a watch is more
vague. A watch? Yeah.
You might as well just say 8:15.
There it is.
It's a good point. The new book is Zoom. It's on Little Brown. Bob Berman is our guest, and we will go back to the phones momentarily. 1-800-348-2551. Joel in Hillsdale. Joel.
Yeah, hi, Ray. The Achilles heel of the communications business with entanglement is that, okay, you create an entangled pair of particles. How do you get the one pair out halfway across the universe to be able to communicate with it?
Ah, there you go. You see? So the caller earlier on who was so excited about using it for communications, easier said than done, right?
Right. You still have to, at least at this point, transfer it at no more than light speed to get where you want it to communicate to.
Yeah. Can there be this spooky action with more than two particles? In other words, could they flip in sympathy?
No, they're pairs.
It has to be pairs.
Well, they're pairs because what they're using are properties such as spin that only have two possibilities, or polarized light that's either horizontally polarized or vertically polarized. So these are the two. When the pairs come into existence, each one has one of the two properties.
When we actually were able to figure out actually how to control the state of the one so it can actually transfer data, it still may be useful, but unless somebody solves the light speed problem for transport, it's only going to be a relatively local communication phenomena.
Right. And also, since you seem very knowledgeable about this, let me ask, how would you determine what the particle in front of you that's going to be the so-called sending particle, and I'm aware there's no real sending receiver, rather it's a synchronicity here, but how would you use that to send information when what the particle is going to do when its wave function collapses, it will be random. It'll be one state or another, but you can't control it, right or wrong.
Well, at least at this point, we don't know how to control a state vector collapse. But, strange things happen, and we may understand more about that in the future.
But how would you even encode any information on that?
That's right, caller. How would you do that?
Right. And that's a good question. That has to be answered. If you can, that was my caveat. If, in fact, you can encode that in the future in some way, you're still limited to the range of communication that provides you.
Fair enough. Joel, great call. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Some ethereal music for you now.
Support for WAMC comes from Edward Garbasek, Certified Financial Planner, Havoc and Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts. Providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement, havocandwealthstrategies.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. Fleet Feet Sports, Colony and Malta, New York, locally owned specialty running shops featuring footwear, apparel, and training programs for all distances, all abilities, fleetfeetalbany.com. Gothic Inn, Block Island, Rhode Island, a Victorian bed and breakfast perched high overlooking Crescent Beach, a short walk from the town and the ferry, dogs are welcome, thegothicinn.com. And the Green River Festival in Greenfield, Massachusetts. More than 30 bands on three stages, plus hot air balloons, entertainment, and more, July 12th and 13th. GreenRiverFestival.com for info.
You're feeling very sleepy. Your eyes are getting heavy. Soothing sleep is upon you.
All right, back to the show. It's Vox Pop. Bob Berman is here. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Bob, you're always leading your minions like a Pied Piper in some direction or other. Where are you headed next?
My favorite of all the places that we go, Chile and Peru and Australia, New Zealand. I'm just thinking Alaska.
Sure.
My favorite is Chile because
why?
The people are friendly. The Atacama Desert is amazing, driest on Earth. And we rent an entire Andes mountaintop for two nights, which has the darkest skies in the world. Last year, we had 90 people with us. This year, it's going to be much smaller.
Wow.
And several of them had been to the Antarctica, and they said these skies were even darker. Because some of the world's largest observatories are within sight all around us. They're all choosing this for these intensely dark, amazing skies. The Milky Way casts your shadow.
Oh, that's amazing.
You see your shadow by Milky Way light. And we have these giant telescopes with three astronomers just standing by, pointing them at the most amazing places in the sky. So it's not just little colonial green valleys in the Andes that take people there, but it's just great. Berman Astronomy Tours.
Okay.
For anyone who that appeals to, it's my favorite tour. Please come.
That's exciting. Now, if we were in the Andes now and it was night and dark, would we be able to see Pluto?
Yes, Pluto. Segue to that poor demoted planet.
Yes,
you know, this
X-planet.
People are really still upset about it. It's 2006 since the IAU made that decision to demote Pluto, turn it into a dwarf planet. That's what it's called. It's a dwarf now, like all the other Disney characters. You know, they are always have dwarfs. Maybe that's why they did it.
All right.
By the way, did you know that the Disney talking dog, actually, he's not a talking dog. He's the only character.
Pluto.
That's right. The only cartoon character that does not have a speaking role was originally Rover in his first cartoon in 1930. And in 1931, 1 year after Pluto was discovered, the Disney people decided to try to exploit this global fame for the name Pluto, and they changed the name to Pluto.
Wow.
So there is really a tie in there between the two. Anyway, Pluto's coming closest to us of the year tomorrow, July 4th.
If we went outside and looked for it, can you see it with your naked eye?
It's tonight, Ray. It's tonight. I said tomorrow, but it's really the wee hours of the morning. So tonight's when Pluto is closest. No, it's not even close. It's 14th magnitude, which, let's see, 6th is the faintest, so it's 8 magnitudes fainter than the faintest. That's 100. That's 600 times. I just worked that out just now. 600 times fainter than the dimmest star.
Well, that's exciting news. We can't see it, and I'm really glad.
Well, you know why you can't see it, and that's why it was demoted, because it's only 1,400 miles across. Our moon is 2160, so it's about half the size of our moon, a little tiny thing. So we call it a dwarf planet, and while we're at changing things, we changed one of the four big asteroids, Ceres. It's spelled as if it were Sears, like Sears and Roebuck. It's C-E-R-E-S, pronounced Ceres. Ceres, we decided because it's round, it's the only asteroid that's a ball.
All right.
It should be a dwarf planet, too. So now we have Pluto, no longer a planet, it's a dwarf planet. Ceres, no longer an asteroid, it's a dwarf planet. And it's meeting, just for fun, the brightest of the asteroids, Vesta, tonight in the constellation Virgo. Boom, they're coming together in the sky. Vesta is the only asteroid you could see. You asked me if
with I ever saw it.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Really?
Naked eye.
So Ceres, it was an asteroid. It travels like an asteroid. It looks like an asteroid, except that it's spherical.
Just don't step on it.
Okay, but can a planet, can it be a mini planet if it's traveling that huge orbit?
No, and that's, well, it could be a planet in a huge orbit, but everybody's still going to call it an asteroid because it's one of the asteroids in the asteroid belt.
Okay.
You know, like, it's like, come on, guys, give us a break.
All right, let's go
to
asteroid. Ernie in Fairfax, Vermont. Ernie, you're on.
Okay, Mr. Vermin.
Yeah.
I'm calling about a question that I heard or on the radio on VPR the other day. They were talking about absolute zero, and they were talking about freezing humans at absolute zero in order to possibly cure arthritis. It would be a very quick freeze. All the blood would go to your heart and vital organs, and then they would thaw you out, and it would gradually go back, and it was a possible cure for arthritis. So I just wondered if you had any info on that.
Well, I think it would depend upon what HMO you had and what kind of plan
all
you
right,
had.
All right, Bob.
You know. I don't know that HMOs would pay for it.
No, you're
I'd
right.
I'd rather have the arthritis than be frozen to absolute zero.
Yeah, you've never heard anything about it, huh?
No, it's kind of outside my field, but
yeah,
but you know he's got another book coming, and Lord knows what the publisher will say. You know, Bob, we got to do this absolute zero topic.
That would be good.
Hey, yeah. Man, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye now. Let's go to Chris in Pittsfield. Chris.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I have a question about refraction. If you took a clear glass container and put it in a swimming pool and they had similar indexes of refraction, how would you see the glass?
Well, it would be very difficult. It would be impossible if they had the exact same index of refraction, but they don't, because light moves at 120,000 miles per second moving through glass, as opposed to 186,282 through the vacuum of space. And through water, it's a somewhat different speed. And as you know, the different densities traveling between the objects with the different densities produces the different speeds of light, and that's what refracts or bends each color separately. But, yeah. You know, you have an interesting point. If you had glass that had the same density as water under the water, you certainly couldn't see it. It would be transparent.
Okay, so I have a second question about putting on a mask and going underwater. How is it that corrects your vision?
Does it correct your vision?
It does, yeah. I'm nearsighted. When I put a mask on and...
You mean just a regular mask?
Oh, really?
You don't even need a corrective one.
So lens-like properties.
Nothing.
Yeah, because Marcy, school teacher Marcy, who has very bad vision, has a special snorkeling mask that's made for a prescription. And then
really?
that corrects it. But that's interesting. Well, you know what? Probably I'm just guessing here that something about the refraction between the glass and the water changes the maybe magnifies. You know how fish look absolutely enormous under the water? They get really scary. You know, those little barracudas, which kind of are a little scary to begin with, look enormous.
Yeah.
So that's probably why. And those sharks off Martha's Vineyard, which are actually only about 2 or 3 inches across, they say that when you actually see them up close, they look big.
What are you talking about? I'm not sure what's happened to this program, Chris, but, you know, I apologize. And
thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You know, Bob, what the heck? Were you across the street having a couple cocktails before the show? Dennis in Kingston. Dennis.
Oh, hi. Hello.
Hi.
I missed you before because of the delay. I was listening to the radio.
Oh, well, you're on now.
Yeah, good. The question I have is about the moon, and how come, I wonder if Dr. Berman would say something about how come the moon, the face of the moon is always the same face facing toward Earth. It never changes, and I find this amazing.
It is kind of amazing, and the Greeks were astonished by it, both because you have the same markings all the time, meaning that it makes one rotation in exactly the same period in which it goes around us, 27.32166 days. Precise, and that's the same for both periods. But the more you look at it, the less amazing it becomes, because every other moon in the solar system belonging to every other planet also has one side that faces their parent planet and the other side faces away. So it turns out that you get a captured or synchronous rotation just from the tidal effects of the more massive body, and Earth weighs 81 times more than the moon does. So as the moon spun over billions of years, the part that's closest to us has a little bit more gravity than the rest, and eventually it was slowed down until there's almost a string between the nearest spot on Earth and the nearest spot on the moon, so that it's tidally locked, forcing that string to always remain in place as the moon goes around us. That string is always there. So it's true of every other moon, of every other body. So it's amazing, but it's not remarkable.
Well, thank you very much. I really wanted to know if it happened to all the other moons too. They all have that effect.
They all have that. And Pluto and its moon Charon, the other way around. Pluto, one side of Pluto faces Charon all the time, just as one side of Charon faces Pluto, and they both go around each other in a little under a week.
Are they fairly close in mass?
Yes, they are. There's only about a 4-to-1 ratio. Hmm. So. And we're going to have the same thing with our moon, too. Earth is going to have one side having the moon, but this is going to be over a billion years from now, and one side that people with that kind of real estate, it'll probably affect real estate values.
Probably.
You know, you'll have property that never sees the moon, and then half the Earth will see the moon. And that'll happen to us, too.
Okay. Hey, Dennis, thank you. Great call.
Okay, bye.
1-800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. His new book is Zoom on Little Brown. So I don't know if you saw this. There was a false color picture put out a week or two ago of the moon. It was from one of these orbiting satellites. I'm not sure which, but it maps the gravity of the moon, and they color-coded the different gravitational sections of the moon. First of all, explain to me how there can be different levels of gravity within one body.
Well, those are called mass cons, and those massive extra little mass areas we think are places that the moon got clobbered by impacts of perhaps asteroids in the past. So they have because the moon's overall density is lower than ours. It's only about a third of Earth. So the moon's a low-density object, and so, bam, it gets hit in a few places and it has concentrations.
Does that mean there's more heavy metals there? If we wanted to mine in the future, we would hit those spots with the heavier gravity?
Yeah, maybe. The moon is pretty absent of that, because half of the moon is oxygen, just pure oxygen, half.
Might be handy.
And then a quarter of the moon is aluminum, which isn't, silicon, not silicone, you know. Silicon.
Right.
And then comes aluminum. But there's not a lot of heavy things, unlike Earth, you know, with our nickel iron core.
Okay.
The moon doesn't have that.
All right, let's go to Gene in Parksville. Gene, you're on.
Hello. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
We spoke once before where I brought up the subject, I think it was like last year, about interplaning. Anyhow, my questions are directly related to mass and volume of the Earth. So if we take the period of time in the Earth's development before humans inhabited the Earth and all the crude oil reserves were finished forming, and all the coal deposits were formed and all the natural gas was formed, then if we take that point and we go to the present time, I would like to know what's the result of us expending those volumes of crude and the solid matter of coal and the gas, because we're not replenishing it. And how does that affect the Earth?
Oh, I see. You're talking about like you were creating holes in there and, you know, what's going on when we take things out and we're not replacing
okay.
it. But
right, yes. We're taking the oil and we're converting it into heat that's going into the atmosphere and so on
and
so forth.
Right. And I hear what you're saying. Of course, this is a bit outside my field, but given the Earth's huge volume, our diameter is 7,926 miles, so you can figure out how many cubic miles of Earth there is, and by comparison, how many cubic miles of coal and oil are removed, and I would think that it would really be minuscule, considering that we've never even succeeded in going down more than a few miles. Even our deepest wells are what? I forgot what the figure is, but something like 10 miles compared to the 4,000 that you need to go to the center of the Earth. So most of the Earth is below the crust, and then you get to the mantle, and so we're barely touching it.
Okay, let's go to Harold in Bolton Landing. Harold, you're on.
Yeah, I've been watching the sunrise and sunset as it's been listed in our local paper, and it seemed as though sunrise and sunset were each, sunrise was earlier by a minute and sunset was farther out by a minute, until it got to be around the 6th or the 8th of June, and then it seemed like sunrise stalled at 5:14 in the morning, and sunset continued to get later. And then about June 21st, sunrise began to get later, and sunset stalled at about 8:39 and continued that way for about a week.
This is a pretty popular question.
It's still continuing. It's still not finished. It continues till about now we get the latest sunsets. And you raise right. We get that all the time, and it's a good question. Why aren't the extremes reached on the day of the summer solstice on June 21st? Why do we have an earliest sunrise in the early part of June and the latest sunset in the early part of July? Why they're symmetrical, but why aren't they all at the same time? And it just has to do with how our clocks match up with the sky. Remember, it's all, when you're talking about time, you're talking about our clocks.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to see this, and I just wish I had a chalkboard, and I don't, and we don't have the time to do this, is the analemma, which is a figure eight shape that represents where the sun is on any given date at the same time. And as that analemma crosses the sky, where its tangent or hits the horizon, either at the morning or the afternoon time, the date that it hits that determines the earliest sunset or the latest sunrise. And if you look at this online, because you really need some diagrams to see this clearly, analemma, sunrise, sunset, why is the earliest not corresponding with the latest? That can make it clear. I wish I had a little chalkboard or a flip chart. I could do that for you right now, but I can't.
Okay, well, that's a start.
Thanks, Harold. Appreciate it. Is time, as we perceive it and as we measure it, just an artificial construct?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. I just finished writing an article about that. Some brilliant people like Isaac Newton thought that it's real, that, in other words, there's really such a thing as time. It's one of the dimensions of the universe. But other smart people in history, such as Immanuel Kant, said that, no, time is not real. It's not something that events can travel through. And if that view is correct, well, you certainly shouldn't be able to travel through time or measure it per se. So it's been debated for a long time. The consensus is that it's not a real thing. It's a construction of us humans, the way we, like our numbering system or the way we order spatial objects. It's an ordering system, an organizational system by us rather than an actual dimension in nature.
Okay, so then if it's artificial construct, we can go on for about another 45 minutes and no one will care, right?
Sure.
Well, actually, we're out of time. Bob, the new book is Zoom. It's on Little Brown, and it's all about vibrations and mice, and we've talked a lot about it, and can't wait to get my hands on a copy, and I will certainly give you an honest review.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening today. Support comes from Metroland, an alternative news weekly serving New York's Capital Region and Western Massachusetts. Williamstown Theater Festival, Williamstown, Massachusetts, presenting The Ring Lardner and George S. Kaufman's comedy June Moon, directed by Jessica Stone, on the main stage through July 13th, WTFestival.org. Scott Alarm Systems, licensed security and fire detection and cell phone and web home automation, monitored by a 24/7 local central station for commercial as well as weekend and full-time residential customers, ScottAlarmSystems.com. And the Schoharie River Center, announcing Otsego Lake Summer Ecology Field School, ages 13 through 17, studying at Otsego Lake. There's a typo here. It's Otsego Lake Ecology by sailboat, July 28th through August 8th, SchoharieRiverCenter.org. That's it for the show. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Your phones were answered by Mike Allinger. Jessica Blaustein Marshall is our producer. Thanks to Bob Berman. Zoom is the new book. Tomorrow it's a holiday, but we'll be back on Monday with a Medical Monday. Have a great holiday weekend.